Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
In Charleston, South Carolina today, a young man who seems to so many to be the embodiment of evil and the deadly consequences of hatred will defend himself in a courtroom. Convicted mass murderer Dylan Roof's sentencing trial has resumed after a judge ruled for a second time in a sealed hearing that Roof was competent to stand trial and can represent himself. Roof says he will not present any witnesses on his behalf. The jury has already begun hearing victim testimony from some of the more than 30 prosecution witnesses, including family and loved ones of the church members who died in the massacre that he was responsible for. Jennifer Berry Hawes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Post and Courier in Charleston and author of an upcoming book, Amazing Grace, about the Emmanuel AME church shooting. She has steadfastly been in this somber, unusual courtroom. Jennifer, how does it feel to be in there?
It's really bizarre most of the time. Roof sits there almost like a statue at his table, staring in front of him while the family members and earlier the survivors give these harrowing accounts of what happened and just really heartbreaking testimony about the loss of their loved ones. And to see him just sit there with no emotion at all, not looking at them, not seeming to really be paying much attention is just really surreal.
Have there been any attempts to interact with him by the defense or by some of these victims? I know the court has admonished people not to do so.
Really, not very much toward him. The judge will speak to him, of course, because he's acting as his own attorney, and the prosecutor will walk over and hand him photographs to object or not object to admitting into evidence. But otherwise, really the only interaction with him and in any of the families or survivors was when Felicia Sanders was testifying, and she said something to the effect of that, and that man over there who can't even look at me right now, said this to my son. And otherwise, he's almost like a non-presence in some ways, other than, of course, everybody's hyper aware of his presence, but he doesn't really speak, doesn't look at anybody, doesn't show any emotion. So he's representing himself, but in a way, it's almost as if the defense table is non-existent. It is, of course, but he rarely objects. He doesn't speak much. His opening statement was extremely short, kind of strange. So he's in some ways a non-entity. The prosecutors have really been able to present heartbreaking testimony while he sort of sits there and doesn't seem to care a whole lot.
Jennifer Berry Hawes is watchdog and public service reporter for The Post and Courier and author of the upcoming book Amazing Grace about the Emmanuel AME church shooting, where she is attending the trial of Dylan Roof. Jennifer Berry Hawes, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We go now to John Bloom, Samuel F. Leibowitz Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project at Cornell Law School. Professor Bloom, how much of the proceedings in South Carolina are, you know, just for this particular trial? Are the movement restrictions on Dylan Roof related to the fact that he's defending himself and some sense that things may go off the rails?
Well, it's unclear. There's not really necessarily a stated reason as for why. Normally, when someone is restricted like that, there's some expectation that they might, try and assault or attack a witness or someone or the judge or something. And as near as I can tell, there's been no indication of that. I mean, Roof is basically quiet, subdued, in many respects, almost non-existent at his own trial.
Is it possible that any of the rules, even something innocuous seeming as the movement restrictions on the defendant, might be grounds for an appeal?
I think it's certainly potentially possible. There would be questions of, has he objected to this and is it preserved? But I think the danger is, or a danger in this, is it could give the jury the perception, the even enhanced perception, that he is dangerous to them personally or to the witnesses under circumstances where, again, there's no evidence that I'm aware of that would suggest that that's true. So, you have this imbalance to begin with that Roof is not presenting or doesn't intend to present a case in mitigation, which is something normally the jury would balance. And then you set that aside, the fact that he is basically his movement is being restricted. He's required to sort of sit if he's going to ask anyone anything. And so I think that could enhance the perception of dangerousness.
Although he did kill the people in the church. So, there is one data point that suggests danger.
But there's no indication that he is actually dangerous to – that he has any plan or to attack the jury or to attack a witness or to do anything of that nature.
The judge in this case seems to be very meticulously honoring the request by Dylan Roof that mental illness not be a factor in evaluating him in court testimony, depending – I mean, I guess we don't know what the jury is going to do.
Right. I mean, he has allowed Roof to represent himself, knowing that Roof doesn't intend to allow any evidence to be presented about his mental state or mental condition. And that's going to further complicate the jury's decision making.
Why do you think it's going to complicate it?
Well, because, I mean, normally when the Supreme Court put the death penalty back in business in 1976, it had a certain anticipation of how capital trials would work. The prosecution would present its case for death, why the defendant should be sentenced to death. The defense would present their case for life, what's called the case in mitigation, where they would present evidence about the defendant's life and background, any mental illness or mental impairments that they might have. And then the jury would make, you know, what's been called legally a reasoned moral response, balancing the aggravation and mitigation and select the appropriate punishment. In this case, they're only going to hear one half of the equation, the government's case for death. Roof has been cleared that he doesn't intend to present anything in mitigation, and clearly he has blocked any evidence about mental impairments or mental illness.
Do you feel as though the jury might actually just have a simple choice here, though, if it goes the way it's been continuing, very quiet and sort of steady, that here's a young man who wants to be considered mentally healthy, he's ready to take his punishment, you know what I mean?
That assumes, of course, that he doesn't really have any mental illness or mental impairment.
Right.
And that he's making this sort of, you know, rational decision with a clean and sound mind, that he accepts the responsibility for what he did and is prepared to be sentenced to death and executed. The problem is, in some of this, we don't really know. I mean, there have been these closed hearings at which the evidence about his mental illness and mental impairment has been presented. So we don't really know what that evidence is. But we do know that there's some, and his lawyers wanted to present it, and that he has blocked it. So I think there's some reason to question the assumption that he is, you know, doing all this rationally, and that this isn't really the product of someone who, in fact, is quite disturbed.
Professor John Bloom, Samuel F. Leibowitz, Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project at Cornell Law School. Thanks so much, Professor.
Yes, thanks for having me.